like the rector of Louvain University, who told Oliver Goldsmith that, as he had become the head of that institution without knowing Greek, he failed to see why it should be taught there, the chiefs of state, having obtained the highest position in their respective countries without more than an inkling of international affairs, were unable to realize the importance of mastering them or the impossibility of repairing the omission as they went along. What they lacked, however, might in some perceptible degree have been supplied by enlisting as their helpers men more happily endowed than themselves, but they deliberately chose mediocrities. It's a mark of genial spirits that they are well served, but the plenipotentiaries of the conference were not characterized by it. Away in the background, some of them had familiars or casual prompters to whose counsels they were wont to listen, but many of the adjoints who moved in the limelight of the world stage were gritless and pithless. As the heads of the principal governments implicitly claimed to be the authorized spokesmen of the human race, and endowed with unlimited powers, it's worth noting that this claim was boldly challenged by the people's organs in the press. Nearly all the journals read by the masses objected from the first to the dictatorship of the group of premiers, Mr. Wilson being accepted. The restriction upon our space in this outline won't allow us to tell here how the peace conference shrank from a council of 10 to a council of 4, Wilson, Clemenceau, Lloyd George, and Orlando, and how it became a conference less and less like a frank and open discussion of the future of mankind, and more and more like some old-fashioned diplomatic conspiracy. Great and wonderful had been the hopes that had gathered to Paris. The Paris of the conference, says Dr. Dillon, ceased to be the capital of France. It became a vast cosmopolitan caravansary, teeming with unwonted aspects of life and turmoil, filled with curious samples of the races, tribes, and tongues of four continents who came to watch and wait for the mysterious tomorrow. An Arabian Nights touch was imparted to the dissolving panorama by strange visitants from Tartary and Kurdistan, Korea and Azerbaijan, Armenia, Persia, and the Hejaz, men with patriarchal beards and scimitar-shaped noses, and others from desert and oasis, from Samarkand and Bukhara. Turbans and fezes, sugar-loaf hats and headgear resembling episcopal mitres, old military uniforms devised for the embryonic armies of new states on the eve of perpetual peace, snowy white burnouses, flowing mantles and graceful garments like the Roman toga contributed to create an atmosphere of dreamy unreality in the city where the grimmest of realities were being faced and coped with. Then came the men of wealth, of intellect, of industrial enterprise, and the seed-bearers of the ethical new ordering, members of economic committees from the United States, Britain, Italy, Poland, Russia, India, and Japan, representatives of naphtha industries and far-off coal mines, pilgrims, fanatics, and charlatans from all climes, priests of all religions, preachers of every doctrine, who mingled with princes, field marshals, statesmen, anarchists, builders up and pullers down, all of them burned with desire to be near to the crucible in which the political and social systems of the world were to be melted and recast. Every day in my walks, in my apartment, or at restaurants, I met emissaries from lands and peoples whose very names had seldom been heard of before in the West. A delegation from the Pont Euxine Greeks called on me, and discoursed of their ancient cities of Trebizond, Samsun, Tripoli, Karasund, in which I resided many years ago, and informed me that they too desired to become welded into an independent Greek republic, and had come to have their claims allowed. The Albanians were represented by my old friend Turkan Pasha, on the one hand, and by my friend Esat Pasha, on the other, the former desirous of Italy's protection, the latter demanding complete independence. Chinamen, Japanese, Koreans, Hindus, Kyrgyzs, Lesghians, Circassians, Mingrelians, Buryats, Malays, and Negroes and Negroids from Africa and America were among the tribes and tongues foregathered in Paris to watch the rebuilding of the political world system and to see where they came in. To this thronging, amazing Paris, agape for a new world, came President Wilson, and found its gathering forces dominated by a personality narrower, in every way more limited and beyond comparison more forcible than himself, the French Premier, Monsieur Clemenceau. At the instance of President Wilson, Monsieur Clemenceau was elected president of the conference. It was, said President Wilson, a special tribute to the sufferings and sacrifices of France. And that, unhappily, sounded the keynote of the conference, whose sole business should have been with the future of mankind. Georges Benjamin Clemenceau was an old journalist politician, a great denouncer of abuses, a great upsetter of governments, a doctor who had, while a municipal councillor, kept a free clinic, and a fierce, experienced duelist. None of his duels ended fatally, but he faced them with great intrepidity. He had passed from the medical school to Republican journalism in the days of the Empire. In those days he was an extremist of the left. He was, for a time, a teacher in America, and he married and divorced an American wife. He was 30 in the eventful year 1871. He returned to France after Sedan and flung himself into the stormy politics of the defeated nation with great fire and vigor. Thereafter, France was his world, the France of vigorous journalism, high-spirited personal quarrels, challenges, confrontations, scenes, dramatic effects, and witticisms at any cost. He was what people call fierce stuff. He was nicknamed the Tiger, and he seems to have been rather proud of his nickname. Professional patriot, rather than statesman and thinker, this was the man whom the war had flung up to misrepresent the fine mind and the generous spirit of France. His limitations had a profound effect upon the conference, which was further coloured by the dramatic resort for the purpose of signature to the very Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, in which Germany had triumphed and proclaimed her unity. There the Germans were to sign. To Monsieur Clemenceau and to France, in that atmosphere, the war ceased to seem a world war. It was merely the sequel of the previous conflict of the terrible year, the downfall and punishment of offending Germany. The world had to be made safe for democracy, said President Wilson. That, from Monsieur Clemenceau's expressed point of view, was talking like Jesus Christ. The world had to be made safe for Paris. Talking like Jesus Christ seemed a very ridiculous thing to many of those brilliant rather than sound diplomatists and politicians who made the year 1919 supreme in the history of human insufficiency. Another flash of the Tiger's wit, it may be noted, was that President Wilson, with his 14 points, was worse than God Almighty. Le bon Dieu only had 10. Monsieur Clemenceau sat with Signor Orlando in the more central chairs of a semicircle of four in front of the fire, says Keynes. He wore a black frock coat and grey suede gloves, which he never removed during these sessions. He was, it to be noted, the only one of these four reconstructors of the world who could understand and speak both French and English. The aims of Monsieur Clemenceau were simple and, in a manner, attainable. He wanted all the settlement of 1871 undone. He wanted Germany punished as though she was a uniquely sinful nation and France a sinless martyr land. He wanted Germany so crippled and devastated as never more to be able to stand up to France. He wanted to hurt and humiliate Germany more than France had been hurt and humiliated in 1871. He didn't care if in breaking Germany Europe was broken. His mind didn't go far enough beyond the Rhine to understand that possibility.